Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. The very name Coney Island is synonymous with amusement parks, but what did its creators intend when they built the amusement park, and how did it change America's idea of public amusement? That's the subject of this week's interview with historian and author Woody Register. And Alan Winkler will be with us once again, this time providing his historical perspective on the Enron scandal. But before we get to those subjects, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. On April 18, 1945, one of the most famous and popular news correspondents of World War II died while on duty overseas. Newspaper reporter Ernie Pyle was killed by a Japanese sniper's bullet only a few months after he arrived in the Pacific Theater to report on the U.S. Marines' invasion of Iwo Jima and Okinawa. Pyle's extensive coverage of the war from December 1940 until April 1945 constituted a lifetime's work of exceptional correspondence. Before the war, Pyle worked for notable publications such as the Washington Daily News and New York's Evening World and Evening Post, establishing his reputation as a popular writer of human interest stories and generally lighthearted columns. With the outbreak of war, Pyle traveled overseas to report on the German bombardment of London during the Battle of Britain. In late 1942, he arrived in North Africa, from which he followed the Allied invasion force into Italy in late 1943 and into Normandy in June 1944. Pyle's sensitive, often humorous portrayal of the ordinary American GI's combat experiences was very popular with the reading public and with ordinary soldiers. While many World War II correspondents devoted their attention to politics, strategy, and personality sketches of famous military and political leaders, Pyle dedicated his war reporting to the enlisted man. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, for centuries, the oracle at Delphi answered questions and made prophecies on behalf of the ancient Greek gods. The oracle's divine utterances, made in a trance-like state, were understood by the ancient Greek people to have been induced by intoxicating vapors rising from the Delphi temple's floor, an explanation which modern scholars have dismissed as false, until now. A team of experts has discovered that the rock underneath the temple floor is composed of oily limestone fractured by two fault lines, which may very well have allowed strong fumes, like the potent sweet-smelling ethylene gas, to rise to the surface and produce hallucinations. This is Talking History. Before Walt Disney, there was Fred Thompson. Before Disneyland, there was Coney Island, Thompson's creation. This week on Talking History, Eileen Dugan explores Thompson's contribution to the rise of public amusements in America.
In a recent commercial campaign for Disney World, 30-something children react with amazement that their parents would want to go to the Magic Kingdom. "What will they do?" the children whisper. "How could they possibly have fun? Don't they know that amusement parks are only really meant for kids?" they ask, as we watch the parents splash and dance and wear Mickey Mouse ears. Is this an aberration, or is this a return to one man's vision of what amusements were to do, to bring out the kid in us? With us to explore mass entertainment in turn-of-the-century America is Dr. Woody Register, Associate Professor of American Studies at Sewanee, the University of the South. Dr. Register is the author of The Kid of Coney Island, Fred Thompson, and the Rise of American Amusements. Welcome, Dr. Register.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Who was Fred Thompson?
That's a good question, because I expect that hardly anyone in this country today would recognize that name. Fred Thompson, I think it's fair to say, gave us what we would recognize today as the theme park, the amusement park that we know so well, that you sketched in your outline of Disney World at the beginning. And I think this is an accomplishment worth paying attention to.
And what do we know of his life before he began designing amusement parks?
I think one thing worth mentioning about Fred Thompson was that he was a very ordinary person for his time. That is, he came from ordinary circumstances, a respectable middle-class family. Although he's born in Ohio, he really grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, and His father was a businessman, an engineer, he sometimes called himself. So he came from, I think, ordinary middle-class circumstances. But from a very early point in his life, he acted out a kind of rebellion against his family's expectations. And I think this is what really presaged his career in American amusements, that rebellion, if you like. I think in some ways it's kind of comparable to Benjamin Franklin's rebellion in his autobiography, where he's a source of constant anxiety and irritation, if not anger, for his father, who tries to place him in some good place in life. Thompson really rebelled against his father's expectations that he would follow in his footsteps and be a businessman. What Thompson really wanted to do was to have fun. This from his childhood into his adulthood. He was constantly seeking for some wider horizon of opportunities than simply being a respectable middle-class man. He wanted excitement. He wanted thrills. And he really wasn't satisfied until he found some way to make a living by having a good time.
What to Thompson was the purpose of public amusement, and who was his target audience when he began?
Well, when he began, I'm not sure that he quite had a target audience except himself, that is, to enjoy what he was doing. I think he would have said that the purpose of his amusements was to liberate Americans, especially to liberate middle-class American men like himself, who he felt, probably from his own experience at least, that he's imagining in others, that they were burdened by responsibilities, by cares, by weighed down by the drab circumstances of life. And what they wanted was more color, more excitement, more vitality. And I think this was the idea at the core of his amusements, is to open up these opportunities, in his words, to let grown men, and women too, but especially grown men, be children again. Because for Thompson at least, childhood was supposed to have been a time of carefree pleasure, when you did anything that you wanted to. And for him, this was really what he imagined as the antithesis of contemporary life, especially for men like himself, who were anything but carefree. Instead, they're burdened by worries, by anxieties, by having to answer to others, especially to men above them. And I think he really built his amusements and eventually his great Luna Park at Coney Island with the idea that he was creating an alternative world where men could be boys.
Was this part of his own public persona of being the man who was a boy?
I think so. I think this was this image that he had that was one that he cultivated, that he was a child at heart, that he was a boy who had never really grown up. And he encouraged people to think of him in this manner. And I think he spent a lot of money and a lot of time sort of advertising this image of himself. But it was also an image that I think observers at the time almost naturally imposed upon him. It was the way they made sense of what he was doing. Because in 1902, Thompson was a nobody, especially in New York City. No one had heard of him. In 1903, it seemed, he had made Luna Park, at least by the end of 1903, had made Luna Park a part of the everyday vocabulary of ordinary New Yorkers. And so he rocketed onto the scene at this time. And people, you sense from reading the record at the time, struggled to make sense of him. And one way that they did was to put him into this story about a child who refused and had never grown up and who lived every day, as they put it at the time, in Neverland, like Peter Pan.
Yeah, it does very much sound like Peter Pan. Did he play upon that?
He made allusions to Peter Pan. He never called himself one, but certainly others did call him Peter Pan, and they saw nothing, wrong or problematic about seeing him as a Peter Pan. In fact, it was just the opposite. It seemed that they envied his energy, his creativity, his sort of blindness to the boundaries that confined everyone else in life. You know, Thompson did things that he wanted to do. He created things that no one imagined could be created. He made tons of money, or at least it seemed that way, selling these opportunities for escape and liberation. And I think for most commentators, he was an object of wonder and even awe. And that was how they made sense of him. He was, as one person at the time put it, an everyday Peter Pan, a man who lived every day in Neverland.
We've mentioned already a couple of times Luna Park, which was on Coney Island, which Thompson developed. How did this relate to his vision of amusement, and what did it involve?
Well, Luna Park was the amusement park that Thompson opened in the summer of 1903. Coney Island was already had what was recognized at the time as amusement parks. But Thompson's vision was quite different from what had been there before. He sought very consciously to create a sort of self-enclosed, thematically unified alternative world, a new kind of city of play, as he would call it, a playground for the human race. These are all phrases that were thrown about at the time by him or others. And so Luna Park was really unlike any place, I think, that Americans had seen at the time. A brilliantly white city of kind of what he called an oriental skyline. There's onion domes, towers, minarets, pinnacles, as many as he could stuff into its 14-acre original enclosure. It was supposed to be exotic and startlingly new, this was how he would have put it, and that it would strike everyone immediately that way. Furthermore, he outlined the buildings with hundreds of thousands of little electrical lights at a time when electrical light was still something of a novelty for most Americans. So that this place was not only unreal by day, but at night it came alive in a way that no one who had not seen it before could have expected. And was probably, I think it would be fair to say, the most brilliant spot on the planet during each summer night, especially once it was joined by other amusement parks. So this was his vision. It was a city in his own mind. He was a kind of city designer, and he built it to contrast as completely as possible with the ordinary city that the people of his time inhabited in everyday life.
In your book, you describe how Thompson strived to incorporate novelty and the cellar door into his amusements. How is that?
Well, Thompson, in this regard, was not unique, far from it. Many of his amusement colleagues and competitors at the time, like him, believed that what people wanted most and what excited them most was novelty, something new, that they tired quickly of something that pleased them today, and that if they were going to return the next day, they wanted something entirely new. And I think this is one of the reasons we should pay attention to what was happening in the amusement world at the time, and in Coney Island especially, was the sort of reorientation of the American economy to renew itself constantly, to entice consumers by producing new objects, new commodities, with the idea that so that people would constantly be buying. And I think this was at the heart of this new consumer capitalist economy that was developing at that time. So Thompson did it in a rather sensational way. I mean, his idea was that one is the architecture. Renew it constantly. You have 100 towers this year, you must have 250 the next. You must have 500 the next. Even if, you know, it makes no sense to throw up a tower in a particular place, do it anyway. If it doesn't belong, it will get people's attention and excite them. You have to have new entertainments. People grow tired of the same old ones. So he was constantly on the outlook for new and sensational ideas for entertaining people.
For example, sending elephants down slides.
Oh, yeah, little things like that. Gimmicks. They were one of Luna Park's most popular attractions, and it was a perennial attraction, which sort of belies this theory. But in any event, it was the Shoot the Chutes, which was a water slide that people hopped into these flat-bottom boats and went down this water slide that then shot them out over a lake. Thompson's idea, which he, as he worried that this amusement would tire eventually, was why not send elephants down the chutes? Send anything, you know, just as long as it was new. And, regardless of whether it was cruel I think that's a good example of just something that shows how little he really cared about his elephants, which he supposedly cared a lot about. But it was this idea that anything, something more violent, something more explosive, something, if there was a news item, for instance, a sensational battle occurring in Europe at the time or in Africa, he would produce some version of it at Luna Park with an idea that, again, people want to know about it, people want to see it represented, and that this was the heart of entertainment. But Thompson had an idea of what the ideal consumer personality was and how to orient an economy around that personality and to exploit it.
How did he move these ideas into, for example, the Hippodrome or Toyland Grown Up?
Well, the Hippodrome was a project that he took up almost immediately after Luna Park's first season. Luna Park was such a sensation. It was copied all across the United States. Everyone thought Thompson was minting money at Coney Island. But he was not satisfied with just getting rich at Luna Park, and immediately he set out to build this theater right in the heart of New York, and on Sixth Avenue near Times Square. The Hippodrome, when it was completed in 1905 and 1906, was the largest theater in the world. Routinely held 6,000 people for these amazing spectacles that he produced. I think the Hippodrome was his effort to, was really to manufacture these fantasies that he had sketched, and his idea was eventually to distribute them all across the United States, to develop these productions about the theme that he usually developed was about the sort of benefits of play, the benefits of being a child again. Was to turn out these productions and distribute them all over the United States. And initially, it seemed, he was actually going to do that, although it didn't turn out that way. But this was his primary fantasy, and it's one that I think that caught the middle-class imagination at that time, and people bought it with great enthusiasm. In 1915, you mentioned Toyland Grown Up. That was Thompson's last great effort. After he had gone through some very difficult personal circumstances, including a complete bankruptcy, he sought to build this dream world at the 1915 World's Fair in San Francisco. And it was, I think, a step beyond Luna Park in terms of its imagination. It was to be, or at least he designed it to be a kind of gargantuan child's playroom of enormous playthings, toys, so that when adults walked around them, it would seem as though they were the tiny ones in comparison to the toys. It was really a kind of surreal project that never quite came off.
We only have a moment remaining, but what would you say was Thompson's legacy to American entertainment?
Aside from just the idea of the theme park, which I think is very important, it's this fantasy that he had, not only of escape, that middle-class people wish to escape their lives, or to escape the responsibilities, the drabness, the confinement, and to find lives of greater pleasure and greater excitement, but also this fantasy of escaping to a childhood, an imagined childhood, at the beginning of the show, that the grown people will pay money to be children. I think that is one of the way that Thompson put that into a marketable form at Luna Park, at the Hippodrome, and his theatrical productions on Broadway. I won't give him credit for starting this idea or for inventing this idea, but he was an important articulator of it in the early 20th century, and I think it remains very important to the way Americans regard the world and their circumstances in it today.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Register.
Thank you very much.
We have been talking with Dr. Woody Register, Associate Professor of American Studies at Sewanee, the University of the South, and author of The Kid of Coney Island, Fred Thompson, and the Rise of American Amusements.
For our site of the week, we've chosen a museum dedicated to Coney Island, a small but fascinating place filled with Coney Island memorabilia and history. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
For 99 cents, you can get a peek at a fascinating collection of Coney Island memorabilia. The room, which houses the Coney Island Museum, overlooks the landmark rides like the Cyclone roller coaster, the Wonder Wheel, and the Parachute Jump, and it's full of antiques and fun relics of old rides. You'll find the old funhouse distortion mirrors, the boardwalk rolling chairs, vintage bumper cars, and the steeplechase horse. And if you're feeling really adventurous, you can even get a tattoo from Spiderweb, the famous Coney Island tattooist. There is a lecture series that runs from July to September with a variety of topics. And of course, if you can't make it to Coney Island for the tour, you can see some of the vintage photographs and postcards currently in the research area of the museum by going online to ConeyIslandUSA.com. You will also find more information about the museum and any upcoming events.
Turning to our commentary of the week, Alan Winkler, a regular on Talking History, comments on the Enron scandal and the history of big business in the United States. Winkler is Distinguished Professor of History at Miami University of Ohio.
Like most Americans, I'm troubled by the Enron scandal. I'm lucky I didn't own any Enron stock. I've still got my job, and my retirement contributions over the past 30 years are safe. But I am concerned by the crass and illegal behavior of one of the nation's largest and until recently most powerful corporations. And I'm even more bothered by its influence on both government policy and the electoral process. Big business has had a major impact on American society ever since the growth of industrialization and the great wave of mergers in the late 19th century. The empires built by Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller, and other industrial magnates frightened Americans who felt rightly that the public interest was often ignored in a large corporation's relentless pursuit of profit. To that end, the government created the Interstate Commerce Commission in 1887 to regulate big business, and enacted the Sherman Antitrust Act in 1890 to break up combinations that got too big. Despite those legislative initiatives, business continued to make its influence felt. Early in Theodore Roosevelt's presidency, in the first years of the 20th century, financier J.P. Morgan got word of an impending antitrust suit and suggested to Roosevelt that Morgan send his man to Washington to meet the president's man, and together the two subordinates could work out an amicable solution. Roosevelt refused and proceeded with the suit. But businesses continued to do everything it could to influence government policy in its own interest. Sometimes that's involved bribery, as in the Teapot Dome scandal in the 1920s. At other times, it simply led to a wave of lobbyists wreaking havoc in Washington, D.C. Republican administrations have traditionally been more sympathetic to big business than their Democratic counterparts. Dwight D. Eisenhower aggressively sought to promote private sector activity. But even greater support for the business sector came during the presidencies of Ronald Reagan and the elder George Bush. The combination of sizable tax cuts and huge defense expenditures led to budget deficits that spiraled out of control and led to a quadrupling of total national indebtedness between 1980 and 1992. And just as the rich are benefiting from the tax cuts promoted by younger George Bush, the wealthy prospered most of all in the 1980s and early 1990s. This was a decade of money fever, according to author Tom Wolfe. It reflected the triumph of Upper America, according to political analyst Kevin Phillips, an ostentatious celebration of wealth, the political ascendancy of the rich, and a glorification of capitalism, free markets, and finance. This was the business and political culture that brought on the crisis in the savings and loan industry. Republican deregulation allowed institutions to operate without previous restrictions, and high-risk investments made huge profits at the start, only to generate tremendous losses in the end. And the same kind of sleazy activity that characterized Enron's activities, the entire industry went belly up. In this case, taxpayers bailed out the failing industry. And now we've got Enron. Top administration officials have close ties to the energy giant. Most troubling is the advice that led to the administration's energy policy favoring maximization of domestic oil and gas production. Enron is more than a typical political scandal. It reflects the kind of influence peddling and attention to the interests of big business that comes at the expense of everything else. It's time to rein in such excessive influence that has a devastating impact on us all.
You've been listening to Alan M. Winkler, author of The Politics of Propaganda, The Office of War Information, 1942 to 1945, and Life Under a Cloud, American Anxiety About the Atom. If you're in New York in the next few months, as our recommended historical attraction of the week, we suggest you stop by the American Museum of Natural History for the just-opened exhibit on baseball. French-born historian Jacques Barzun wrote, "Whoever wants to know the heart and mind of America had better learn baseball. It's the perfect lens through which to examine our customs, values, and ritualistic practices. Judge for yourself, but cultural relevance aside, the exhibit is just plain fun. Baseball is America features 500 artifacts, including the original Doubleday baseball, shoeless Joe Jackson shoes, the bat Roger Maris used to hit home run number 61, and much more. For more information on the exhibit, Baseball is America, and its future venues, contact the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions, either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Talking History is a production of Creighton University and the Organization of American Historians. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.